The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
From a legal perspective, domestic law, what's the authority to attack this group that is not the Islamic State or in any way connected? And indeed, was from that perspective part of the fight against the Islamic State. What was the domestic legal authority for that? And I think everyone, including myself, who looked at this thought, well, if it's true that these guys just launched 30 rockets that killed an American and wounded others, of course you have unit self-defense and national self-defense concepts
under Article 2.
Under Article 2 of the Constitution. So I didn't view that as a particularly tricky question. And to be frank, I bring the same analysis to bear on the subsequent step of attacking Soleimani, although I recognize, of course, it's a more difficult and complicated question from a legal perspective, let alone from a policy perspective.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 11th, 2020. The National Security Law Podcast is something you should be listening to every week. The brainchild of Bobby Chesney, Lawfare co-founder, and Steve Vladek, both of the University of Texas Law School, is the deepest dive on the national security law subjects of the day available anywhere in podcast land. This week, however, the conversation between the two of them on the Soleimani killing and the law thereof was so fabulous that we thought we would inject it into your feeds through the Lawfare podcast feed as well. So here's what we did. We took the podcast, we edited it down just to the substantive discussions of the law of the strike. So some parts may be a little choppy, move from subject to subject, but we took out everything else and we brought you just the discussion, which is as deep a dive as we get on the subject. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 494, the National Security Law Podcast, guys. Talk Soleimani.
Hello from Austin. Welcome to episode 149 of the National Security Law Podcast. We're brought to you by the Strauss Center at the University of Texas. It's Monday morning, January 6, 2020. I'm Bobby Chesney.
I'm Steve Vladek.
We're going to focus today, I think, Steve, on Iran. Is that right? Iran and Iraq? All right. It's hard to know where to jump in on this, but probably it's best to provide some background before we start tearing into the legal issues. But maybe it's most important.
Legal and policy
Yeah,
issues.
But it's
best. Someone I know gave a pretty good quote to the Washington Post.
Yeah, and I wanted to kind of reprise. Thank you. I want to reprise that a little bit.
Oh, you too.
Yeah. There is a lot of legal discussion coming up, and I think you and I have experienced plenty of times before, but certainly in the past couple of days, it seems hard for some people to hear an assessment of legal frameworks without assuming that, if you're arguing something is or isn't legal, it must be because you want it to be possible to have done that or to have not done that.
So I do want to sort of flag as part of our discussion of the law and policy of everything, also the insanity of what the president is doing and the extent to which some of his public reactions, I think, should be giving ever more cause for concern that, you know, something is not computing, and this is what many of us feared about a president who, like, you know, kind of goes a little cray cray.
Well, so let's get to that. I think that for those of us like me who were never Trump conservatives,
as opposed to me, Well, I'm back to my Twitter trolls.
Right, well, right. Yeah, you, whatever you were, you weren't a conservative.
True.
that could be your title. Back before when it was still the primaries, and suddenly it began to appear that there might actually be some momentum behind that person. A lot of what those of us who were taking this very rigid view against him were concerned about was that he would be a dangerous steward of foreign policy and national defense.
That hasn't turned out at all, though.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, let's start right there. I mean, up to this point, I think it's fair to say that in his interactions with North Korea, with Iran and others, he's had this strange combination of sort of there's the sucking up to
strongmen.
There's the blustering and the sort of the stereotypical bullying and blustering behavior. There's precipitous actions sometimes where he does do things that are confrontational, like, you know, backing out of the nuclear agreement with Iran, that sort of thing. But for the most part, it's been known about him for a long time that he's relatively pro-isolationist in his views about military entanglements, or at least he often frames himself that way. But I think a lot of people felt that that actually was one of his more guiding light commitments insofar as he had any. And so part of what's striking about this is that after so many concrete examples of him wanting to reduce our military footprint overseas and kind of viewing that as sort of, I guess he views it through some kind of financial lens or whatever he views it through, suddenly he's leaning in so aggressively. I think it's part of what caught everyone so by surprise in this latest turn of events. But let's talk about what these latest turn of events are. We shouldn't assume everyone's fully up to speed.
And I do especially like the defense of this, that this is, he just wants to get our troops out of Iraq.
Well, I hadn't heard it put that way, but
there are people out there saying that, you know, defending this nonsense on those grounds.
Well, no, whatever else is true about this, it's not like it's super well thought through, you know, three-dimensional chess. So I think we can rule that out.
On his part, although there is, I mean, there's...
I'm only talking about him.
No, but there's reporting about, you know, Pompeo and, you know, the Secretary of Defense and Esper and Miley and all these guys that, like, this actually had been in the works for a while. But, all right, so...
Right, but you're not saying that those guys were hoping to bring all the troops home and get the U.S. out
of
the Middle
East. No.
Yeah,
no.
I think quite...
To the contrary.
Right, no, that's what I'm saying. Like, yes.
But that's the disconnect here, right?
Well, there are many different decision makers with many different motivations that all coalesce in this one intersection that gave rise to this.
All right, so this all started what? With the... Should we start with the attack on the contractor?
So... No, I think I want to go deeper. There's a report that Reuters... So with this topic, yeah. U.S.-Iranian below-the-radar uses of lethal force and other aggressive forms of interaction, you could, of course, go back decades, and many people are going back decades and pointing out that this is but the latest in a really, really long, sort of lifetime-long series of exchanges of sometimes violent, sometimes nonviolent interactions. But I want to highlight a report that Reuters put out on Saturday. I'm going to read from this because it provides some really helpful context, I think. So again, this is from Reuters, and I'm quoting here. In mid-October, Iranian Major General Qasem Soleimani met with his Iraqi Shiite militia allies at a villa on the banks of the Tigris, looking across at the U.S. Embassy complex in Baghdad. The Revolutionary Guards commander instructed his top ally in Iraq, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, and other powerful militia leaders to step up attacks on U.S. targets in the country using sophisticated new weapons provided by Iran. Two militia commanders and two security services briefed on the gathering told Reuters. And then the article goes on to kind of unpack things, talks about an increase in the supply of Katyusha and other missile capabilities from Iran to the militia groups, especially Kateb Hezbollah, which is Mohandas's group, and how the idea, at least according to these Shiite Iraqi sources who talked to Reuters, the whole idea was to bait the United States into some sort of military action, which might then, A, distract the Iraqi public from its growing unrest over Iranian influence in Iraq, turning their attention instead towards the U.S. Foreign troop presence, and B, perhaps even bait the United States into doing something so provocative that it could end up getting the United States kicked out of Iraq, which is arguably what's unfolding as we speak. In any event,
can we say a bit about why that would be good for Iran?
Yeah, let's frame this. Let's pause there and frame some competing. What are their interests in the area? What are our interests?
So, I mean, short of actually invading and taking over Iraq, which, you know, didn't work so well, right? The first time they tried it, right? I think it's been clear for a while that Iran has Iran has had as a goal significant influence over just politics in Iraq, government in Iraq, but also sectarian violence in Iraq on the theory that instability in Iraq is good for Iran. Right. And so support for Shia militia groups, right, sort of support for sort of different factions, right, in the Iraqi unrest and civil war, right, just sort of stirring the pot because all chaos is good for Iran, but particular chaos is especially good for Iran.
Certainly, I agree in general with all that. So if you're the Iranians, what would you like to have? You'd like the U.S. military to be out of next door to the greatest extent possible.
It gives you free, especially because one of the things you're probably worried about, so long as the U.S. has a military footprint, is provoking the U.S., right? Is sort of, you will have a freer hand to conduct operations in an Iraq where there's no U.S. military presence.
There's no great mystery to it. It's just like China would prefer for the United States not to militarily be in Japan and in South Korea. Iran would certainly
it's
like
no
for
mystery,
us not
but I think,
to be...
I think we sometimes lose sight of the forest when looking at the trees.
Right. So if we ask, like, so who wins if the upshot of all this in the end is the United States is kicked out of Iraq? That's
Iran.
A strategic success for Iran.
Now, can I take this one step further? There are folks who also think it is therefore a strategic success for Russia. I think that's a little more complicated, right? I mean, I think it's certain, like, anything that diminishes the U.S.'s influence in the Middle East probably is good for other, you know, powerful nations that also have interests in the region. But I don't think it's quite as one-to-one.
So, you know, I would argue that for China it's bad in that China benefits from the shipping stability we provide there. I do think Russia is a decently strong indirect beneficiary insofar as their main strategic interest, I would argue, is influence in Syria.
Yep.
If we are out of Iraq, our ability to continue to operate in Syria is further reduced, if not eliminated, which is going to be the next domino follow-on effect.
Although the complication, obviously, is ISIS, right? Because in as much as Russia wants, you know, sort of to support the Assad regime, right? Conditions in which ISIS can flourish are not necessarily conducive to that.
I think that their view would be that we will take care of, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it, and without you guys around, we can crush it.
That's right.
Much more aggressively.
And illegally.
But no doubt about that. Clearly, both in the Shiite leaderships, and I use that plural on purpose, in Iraq, and the Russians and others in the Assad regime, all of them are right now not primarily concerned with crushing the Islamic State, so much as preserving regime stability or leadership stability. All right, so go, you know, turn around, look at it from the U.S. perspective. We could do a similar analysis. What are we there for? You have a multiplicity of interests. Security of energy resources is obviously looming very large. Suppressing ISIS is supposed to be, and for many leaders, is in fact a first-tier security interest as well. Placing pressure and hemming in Iran is clearly a strategic priority. It is hard to see how any of those are advanced, those strategic interests are advanced by getting kicked out of Iraq.
Could I add one more strategic interest? This may be a softer one, but just sort of given everything we've committed already to Iraq, right, that just the legacy of it, right, that sort of, you know, holding up to our end of the bargain, which we haven't always done.
You mean sort of don't throw away whatever gains have been achieved in Iraq?
In many cases, over the blood of American service members.
Yeah, but see, okay, but so now this is where it starts getting tricky, because one way to look at that interest, which I agree is an interest, is that that is already at risk because of the mounting dominance of Iran over the various Shia militias and the politicians.
And the apparent upsurge in sectarian violence again in Iran.
Right, and so from that perspective, the main threat to that strategic interest, and then by extension to the others, is Iranian leveling up of provocations. And this was a way of interjecting a sharp shock to the system.
On Soleimani's part.
That Soleimani was already doing this and escalating bit by bit and not being deterred from taking those further steps. This was a way to change that balance of calculations. So from that perspective, I don't think it's actually as cut and dried as, well, this is obviously insane to have done this, but let's get back to the more immediate track record. So, entirely apart, it's an important part of the conversation to acknowledge that there's a widely believed and asserted, and I have no reason to doubt this is true, set of facts about Soleimani and the Al-Quds forces' responsibility directly and indirectly for the death of American service members and American personnel over the years, not just in Iraq, but certainly in Iraq. More recently, the claim would be that they're directly arming and directly, at least at the strategic level, issuing direction and control to these proxy militias in Iraq. So here's back to that Reuters article. And again, we just set up how in October there was a decision to try to level things up and to try to prompt the U.S. to take some sort of provocative action by continually increasing the scale of the attacks and the sophistication of the attacks. The article goes on to say, quote, on December 11th, a senior U.S. military official said attacks by Iranian-backed groups on bases hosting U.S. forces in Iraq were increasing, becoming more sophisticated, pushing all sides closer to an uncontrollable escalation. His warning came 2 days after 4 Katyusha rockets struck a base near Baghdad International Airport, wounding 5 members of Iraq's elite counterterrorism service. Skipping ahead, on December 27th, more than 30 rockets were fired at an Iraqi military base near the northern Iraq city of Kirkuk. The attack killed a U.S. civilian contractor, wounded 4 Americans, and 2 Iraqi service members. Washington accused Kataib Hezbollah of carrying out the attack, an allegation it denied. The United States then launched airstrikes 2 days later against the militia, killing at least 25 militia fighters, wounding 55. That, of course, okay, that's the end of the quote. That, of course, then immediately led to the apparently at least partially instigated by Soleimani incursion into the U.S. embassy, and then the airstrike that followed against Soleimani and Mohandas themselves, killing them. That's where we got to today. So do you want to jump in at this point? We can talk about what glimpses we're getting in the media about the process of the decision-making, which is pretty interesting, but we have only an incomplete picture there. We can talk about the legality of the first airstrike on Kataib Hezbollah. We can talk about the legality of the killing of Soleimani. Where should we jump in?
I don't know.
let's kind of go in that chronological sequence then, okay. I guess. Before the Soleimani decision, you've got this airstrike against Kataib Hezbollah. It seems to me at the time that that didn't generate a great deal of angst because I think people didn't perceive the same escalation risks because it was an attack on Iraqi PMF forces, who were Iranian proxies, but it wasn't perceived as directly attacking Iran.
I mean, it wasn't attacking a senior Iranian military commander.
Right. So people didn't pay as much attention, didn't get as wound up about it. But from a legal perspective, domestic law, what's the authority to attack this group that is not the Islamic State or in any way connected? And indeed, was from that perspective part of the fight against the Islamic State. What was the domestic legal authority for that? And I think everyone, including myself, who looked at this thought, well, if it's true that these guys just launched 30 rockets that killed an American and wounded others, of course you have unit self-defense and national self-defense concepts
under Article 2.
Yeah. Under Article 2 of the Constitution. So I didn't view that as a particularly tricky question. And to be frank, I bring the same analysis to bear on the subsequent step of attacking Soleimani, although I recognize, of course, it's a more difficult and complicated question from a legal perspective, let alone from a policy perspective. But that's kind of where I'm coming at this from.
I think on the first strike, I see the argument. But, I mean, this is what we're going to get into with Soleimani. Like, I have always understood the Article 2 analysis, right, to include escalation risk, right, as one of the relevant considerations. And, you know, maybe it shouldn't be part of the analysis, at least that's how I've always thought about it. That, like, you know, we don't want a scenario where the president can use one act of self-defense as a way of basically getting us into a war that he couldn't get Congress to otherwise authorize.
Should we unpack sort of in the abstract what little there is to say about the legal doctrine of Article 2 national self-defense?
So, yes, and I think this is actually probably the most important legal and con law point to take away from the last, you know, 5 days, right, which is what I really think the Soleimani attack exposes is just how problematic, right, the sort of legal space we live in. I don't mean problematic from the perspective of what the answers are. I mean problematic from the perspective of there's no accountability, right? That, like, you know, basically the way this operates is the executive branch conducts military operations based on its own analysis of its legal authorities. For obvious reasons, those analyses tend to skew a bit in favor of the executive, right? Whether they're right or not. And, you know, because of both congressional abdication and because of judicial abdication, you know, what OLC says tends to be the law in the space, at least, you know, not because it is right or most convincing, but because it's just, you know, there's nothing else. And I think what we're, so we've known that to be true forever. I mean, right, for as long as we've been doing this, we've understood that. I don't think the average American understands that. And I don't think that, like, you know, like the first airstrike, right, draws the kind of headlines where it's like, wait, the president can do this? And so I guess the, to me, the larger point of this whole thing is, you know, whether you like Trump or don't, whether you like Obama or don't, right, whether you like the executive branch or don't, is this a sort of equilibrium we're comfortable with, right? I mean, is this a world, is this a sort of, is this approach to what the legal, to not what legal answers are, but to who's answering legal questions, is this one that we can be satisfied with?
I think what you've just described is fair and is also entirely analogous to similar realizations that others have had about, say, the national emergency statutory framework or any number of other things we've talked about on the past 148 episodes where, hey, hello, it turns out the executive branch under this particular framework has all this discretion, and it's really been constrained in the past more by the quality of the mind or the morals or the norm acceptance of the office holder than it has by the legal framework. And when it turns out there's someone who's willing to be a norms transgressor on some of those issues, or who acts in a way that's, from a policy perspective, unpopular with those who take a more conventional view, then suddenly you realize, like, oh, wait, the law doesn't constrain like I thought it was. Now, in some of those areas, you've done especially good work in showing how, hey, here's a reasonable alternative framework that would be more constrained. So, for example, on national emergencies. On this one, it's not nearly as clear to me what the more institutionally robust alternative in practical terms, in realistic terms, really would look like. Mm-hmm. Although that doesn't mean to, I'm not gainsaying that it, this proves to be a pretty dangerous amount of discretion, but I'm not sure what the alternative would actually be.
I don't know. I mean, I have some thoughts. I don't think they're very popular thoughts, but I think it's a conversation we ought to be having. And because here's the problem, right? Like, it's not just that we have historically trusted that the executive, the person who actually, where the, you know, the person with whom the buck stops, is going to be someone who, like him or not, agree with him or not, is going to make decisions that we at least understand as to be reasonable ones. It's that the lawyers were understood to be constraints. And I guess I am increasingly skeptical and have been for some time that the lawyers, that the internal executive branch lawyers really are sufficiently effective. I mean, I'm sure they are more than zero constraint, right? But I don't doubt that there is an OLC opinion either in the works or already completed about why the strike on Soleimani was lawful.
But and, to be concerned about that assumes that such an opinion would be wrong, but I don't think it's wrong. I don't think we agree on that.
I think it depends on facts that we don't know, right? I mean, so you know, this is where I think, I mean, we talked about this a lot when we did our deep dive on Alaki, right? Because I think this is, you know, Alaki is probably the case that people are most familiar with before Soleimani, right? Anwar Alaki, U.S. citizen, who we killed in a drone strike in Yemen in, what, 2010, 2011?
And he was AQAP. He was known to be AQAP's primary English language propagandist, but was believed by the U.S. government from intelligence to be intimately and personally involved in directing operational planning, or at least instigating plots outside of Yemen.
And a crucial piece of the analysis was the notion that he posed an imminent threat to the United States, right? Not just a threat in the abstract. And to me, the Article 2 legality, because I don't think there's a case that the 2001 AUMF authorizes the strike against Soleimani. I really don't think there's a case the 2002 AUMF authorized the strike against Soleimani. And with all due respect to the National Security Council spokesperson who said this to reporters last week,
the
War
funding.
Powers Resolution certainly doesn't authorize the strike against Soleimani.
Yeah, can we do this? Because I feel like we need to bring the readers around with us and not jump ahead of ourselves. Yeah. Let's first identify, I think I'm now up to five different statutes that have been mentioned, or at least four. That are not useful here, but keep getting brought up.
Yes.
And then we'll come back to what we started talking about and we were building up to, the Article 2.
So start with the 2001 AUMF, right? So we have exhausted ourselves on the show about why the 2001 AUMF, which Congress passed 1 week after 9/11 to go after Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, doesn't apply to Iran, except maybe in a world where you have a theory about Iran harboring Al-Qaeda in Iran.
And let's be clear about that. So because the vice president incredibly started touting or gesturing towards that theory, which has a wide following in some more obscure corners of the internet, my understanding...
Was this before or after the vice president talked about the 12 hijackers on 9/11?
I That I don't know about. but I do know that he made a reference to trying to tie Soleimani to some sort of way of connecting him to Al-Qaeda. My understanding is that there certainly have been some transactional engagements between Iran and Al-Qaeda, despite their larger theological and policy disagreements and hostilities, including Iran tolerating the presence and allowing the presence of basically Al-Qaeda fugitives within Iran. But having said, I think it's only fair to acknowledge that. But there's no plausible basis on anything that's been shown in the public record that I've seen to suggest that actually Iran in any way or fashion was actually affirmatively supporting Al-Qaeda in connection with 9/11 or as an associated force or as co-belligerent with it or any of the other tests that for two decades now have defined the scope of the 2001 AMF.
No, so 2001 AMF off.
No, so no one, that's a terrible argument. 2002 Iraq AMF is still in the books.
It's at least about Iraq.
Yeah, well, I actually think it's a better argument than the 2001 AMF. To me, the whole question is, did the rather long period where we were out of Iraq, it was over and done with, did that effectively terminate the authority? Or can you really look at where we are today and say, this is just nonstop since the 2003 invasion?
The same conflict Congress authorized in 2002. And this, I mean, it's worth noting that, right, I mean, the House voted to repeal the 2002 Iraq AUMF last year. Right, and it just got nixed in the conference version of the NDAA.
Well, I think that actually that fact cuts against the position because Congress has taken up the question of whether to repeal it and has failed to do so.
Yeah, although
it's clearly still operative.
But what is it authorized? Right, I mean the.
Well, that's why I think that's a better argument. I think the fact that the House took it up and then didn't get it across the finish line is actually a bad fact.
Maybe
for those who want a narrow.
I'm less convinced it's a bad fact.
We have to agree at least that it doesn't actually move the needle because
I just think it's a relevant data point, right? That out there in the world is a conversation about whether the 2002 AUMF is still doing anything. But on the merits, I mean,
I don't want to let this go quite so. If it's not, then why do they need to repeal it? And why would somebody resist repealing it?
Just to take off the table the even arguments like the one that we're having right now.
I don't know. I think it's a bad fact. But I think we agree that on the merits, its scope doesn't encompass an attack on an Iranian general.
Because, right, the whole purpose was sort of regime, like, the whole purpose was defending Iraq, right, and bringing stability to Iraq. And the notion, you know, maybe if the Iraqi government were actually, like, maybe this operation had been carried out in conjunction with the Iraqi government, there'd be a stronger argument in that direction, but so far as we know, it wasn't.
Yeah. So, a third, right, you mentioned the War Powers Resolution, which, of course, ha! By its own terms,
doesn't authorize
anything. Literally and more symbolically, is not itself a grant of authority to do anything. So it really ought not ever to be talked about in that particular
way.
And
it literally says so. Like, I think
that's why I said literally.
It's section 8B or 8C, right?
This shall not be cited as.
Yeah.
All right, so...
That hasn't stopped them.
Another fun one that really annoys me is that there have been a few references to the fact that... the IRGC, the
Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The White House keeps calling it the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps.
So IRGC got added to the list of designated foreign terrorist organizations.
Ah, yes.
And I've seen several sources now acting as if that was the same thing as adding it to the list of associated forces under the AUMF.
No!
The FTO list, my friends.
It has like 60 organizations on it.
Well, it's got tons of them. It is not a grant of use of force. What is it? It triggers third-party liability under the material support laws. It has a bunch of Immigration and Nationality Act consequences. Yeah. It is not in any way a grant of authority. So there's four down. Let me give you a fifth one. Somebody was quoted the day after the attack, someone from the government was quoted, as citing a provision in that provides funding for special operations. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
It's special operations support. 10
U.S.C. 127 or something like
127
that.
127E, I believe it is. Yeah. It's authorization for SOCOM to spend money on allies who are helping us in our counterterrorism operations. It's a funding statute.
It is axiomatic, as the Supreme Court would tell you, that funding statutes are not authorizations.
Well, but it's not even a funding to do this.
Right.
It's money for
Here's
allies.
Here's money to do something.
It's money to give to allies
right.
who are helping us. So those five statutes are nowhere should be driving this conversation.
So before we get back to Article 2, can I say one thing? The fact that Susan Hennessy pointed this out, like the fact that we have heard a shifting series of statutory claims from different spokespeople in the administration is not exactly confidence-inspiring that they went in with a clear sense of what they were doing.
Well, I would, like a friendly amendment, I would say it's clearly the case that they did not settle on a in a regular process sort of way, here's what the legal justification is. Here's, if you get questions, here are the bullet points on how you answer them. Instead, people are freestyling. Now, in fairness, I do think reporters reach out to who they reach out to.
That's right.
Many of these things we've just been knocking down are unnamed officials who are answering questions from reporters. Not all of them, but some. You know, no one named the 127E thing.
No one named the 127, but there are named people like the vice president, the national security advisor, and other named, the DOD spokesperson whose name I don't remember, but who is a real person, who have pointed to each of the first four.
Right. So we agree that it's a total shambles of a process. But let's come around.
This podcast is a total shambles of a process.
Well, that's our motto. Indeed. The Article 2
argument. What's the motto with you?
That's awful. So anyways.
Article 2.
Let's talk about how this basically works. The battle lines, this is a war powers, constitutional separation of powers issue.
Yep, that the Supreme Court has talked about once.
Yes, but boy, did they talk about it in the Price cases in the Civil War.
1863, that old chestnut.
The question, it arises in the following way. It is clear that Article 1 confers the power to declare war on Congress. It is clear that Article 2 confers the commander-in-chief power on the president. It's also clear that at some point during the Constitutional Convention, there was some wrestling with the language of how the declare war power should be framed when given to Congress, because there was an initial idea of having it be the power to make war that caused some of the drafters to say, well, make war sounds a little bit like, you know, sort of how you run things. We don't want to do it that way. We'd had the experience of congressional running things during the revolution itself. It wasn't a happy experience. Long and the short of it is, there's reason to believe from the drafting history that there was an express discussion at the convention about the distinction between running the war when America's been attacked, sort of in what we'll call the national self-defense scenario, where it seemed clear, or as near as we can tell, that people felt, well, you don't need Congress to authorize it if you've been attacked. So we'll call that defense. Whereas the power to take America to war, that was meant to be conferred on Congress. So this gives rise to two really big questions that overhang this entire debate when all future cases arise. One is, what sorts of uses of the military require this debate to take place? That is, when do you have war or something close to war such that you maybe should not be able to proceed without Congress blessing it? Secondly, if you do have that type of use of force, where exactly is the line between offense and defense? When do you have the sort of provocations that can trigger this national self-defense scenario? Steve, as you mentioned, the prize cases in 1863, so in the midst of the Civil War, some of Lincoln's early unilateral war-related actions were challenged in the Admiralty Court's process, and the Supreme Court thought it perfectly appropriate to weigh in on drawing the legal lines within, or clarifying the legal lines on some of these issues, and affirmed that there certainly is an offense-defense distinction, said that the president not only has the authority to use and direct the military when there's been an attack, but has a duty to do so. But that doesn't solve the hard questions, of course, of knowing just which types of provocations get you there. And of course, it also does not weigh in, because the Civil War wasn't a hard question in this respect. It doesn't weigh in on the question of what are the sorts of kinetic engagements that might be so small in scale that don't raise this debate at all. So you've got those two questions that then sort of get developed and practiced over time, over the century and a half that followed. One thing in recent years, over the past 20 years, we've had a number of uses of force. The bigger ones have been under color of AUMFs. They've had congressional approval, so we haven't really faced these sorts of line-drawing issues. The more interesting developments in the past 20 years have come in places like Libya and on the sidelines of Syria with Trump, you know, authorizing a strike here or a strike there, not against the Islamic State, which is assimilated to the AUMF, but rather against the Syrian government. Those scenarios are ones in which we've seen some development from within the executive branch about how exactly it understands just how much authority can be exercised before you have to have these debates about war powers. But the Obama administration and the Trump administration and their predecessor administrations have chosen in a way that's very executive branch friendly to draw the line at a place that I think a lot of people as a layperson would say, wow, that's not war. That's not sufficiently war related. And this is where you get into the idea of national interest, where the risk of escalation, as you mentioned, the risk of escalation is relatively modest, if not de minimis, where U.S. troops are not in sustained ground positions. That's a bit of doctrine that's developed, in my understanding, to define when you can use the military to do
things. Developed within the executive branch.
Yes, developed within the executive branch and implemented in practice to establish when you could use military force without going to Congress, because you don't have to define the defense versus offense distinction because you're below the threshold of war.
Right.
And again, probably the most developed discussions really were publicly vetted during the Libyan intervention. Mm-hmm. Once that started to extend, we saw a lot of development there. And then there was an echo of it, more or less similar, when Trump authorized some episodic strikes against Syrian government forces rather than Islamic State forces.
Which we've talked about a little bit
right.
before.
So I guess one thing to say, having set it all up that way, is the Soleimani strike best understood as being defended from an Article 2 perspective on the ground that, oh, this is below the threshold of war, it doesn't raise these issues, never mind, nothing to see here, as long as there's national interest, right. It's not escalatory, we don't have boots on the ground, it's okay. I don't think so. I think that it actually fares badly on that frame because the escalation risk is so clear.
And latent.
But I think it's a different question to say this was defense. This was prize cases,
right.
defense.
This was
national self-defense. It is a war powers question. We're at that level.
Right.
But it's within the president's authority because we were attacked first.
Hence the war powers resolution notification.
Yeah, I mean, interesting question in my
mind. Because they haven't made notifications for all of these strikes, right? Some of them haven't even bothered to notify.
I'm not up to speed enough to know when precisely they've been doing it. And also, I don't have enough faith in their process to think that that the episodicity of their notifications would reflect a considered position.
Right.
But so the position I'm trying to carve out is... This is
on the national self-defense side, not the national interest
exactly.
low threshold side.
And so therefore, if I'm right about that, and let me underscore that this is based on the premise that the facts being asserted about Soleimani's responsibility for prior acts,
right.
including this run-up of attacks through this fall, are in fact true, or at least well enough established to warrant the action. If it all proves to be false, obviously that doesn't hold up. But I think what it does suggest is that the escalation risk, of course, still looms hugely large from the policy perspective, but I don't think it's actually part of the Article 2 doctrine that I have in mind as being most relevant here. I think that escalation risk is indeed important if what you're arguing is, well, this may not be defensive, but it's
right.
low
intensity. So on the morning of December 7th, 1941, right, if FDR authorizes the use of military force in self-defense against the attack from the Japanese Navy, right, he says, you can go after the aircraft carriers. We didn't have the capability to do it, but imagine
right, but if
said
we'd
that.
Spotted them.
Right. Then your argument would be, obviously, that's a huge escalation risk, right?
Okay.
Like, then we're going to be in an open, all-out shooting war, and FDR turns to be, we already are, right? And so, hell with escalation
I think that
risk.
Would be a super easy case. I might even say it's a paradigm case with one wrinkle. It would be, by definition, anticipatory self-defense if you got them...
Before they bombed us.
Before they launched the planes.
Right.
Although, you can make arguments and have a lot about
right.
it. But if you could take them out in the middle of the Pacific... I would say, yeah, that was anticipatory self-defense, but that was still self-defense.
But so here's the problem, right? So actually, I have two problems. The first is I have a problem with the entire line of low threshold national interest uses of Article 2 power, right? That I really do think that the prize cases are fairly understood as drawing a pretty bright line between defense and offense. And I just am not convinced that acting in our national interest. When not in response to an immediate threat and provocation, falls on the defense side. But, right, putting that... So I actually have a problem with the whole line of OSC
right.
reasoning dating back
right.
to
it's
the...
Like Libya, the Syria one-offs.
I have a problem with all that.
Sure.
And I think
okay.
I've been consistent about that. I hope I've been consistent about that. As you say, I think I am persuaded that that is not this, right? And that the drift of power that we saw in all of those OLC opinions, starting in the Obama administration and working their way into the Syria strikes, right, is not as overtly implicated here, although obviously it's of a piece, right? That, like, you know, if OLC can point to all of these accretions of power, then it looks like there's more and more precedent for what it's doing. The problem I have with the way you've, I think, quite elegantly framed this is that everything rises and falls on imminence, right? Because if, you know, what, and this is the question, why now, right? Like, why last week as opposed to last year? Like, the Obama administration knew where Soleimani was, right, most of the time, right? I'm sure even at the end of the Bush administration, we were tracking Soleimani, right, during this stuff. Like, what is it about now? And is it really just the attacks, plural, last week? Or was this a long time in the making and they were just looking for an excuse, right? Or was it, you know, the sort of super cynical version, right, sort of wag the dog, right, an effort by the president to distract from the bad other domestic headlines? Like, this is, you know, that's what gets my dander up. And what frustrates me to no end is we will never know, right? Because historically, I think the president would have felt obligated to provide a full, even if classified, briefing, right, to the congressional leadership in both parties to assuage separation of powers concerns, to get buy-in from the congressional leadership. We've talked before about how this is not a kind of action that requires Gang of Eight notification by statute, right, but just by tradition. And the president sort of went out of his way not only to not notify congressional Democrats, but, and I realize this is petty, but I want to say this out loud. He retweeted a frickin' Dinesh D'Souza tweet, right, that basically said, yeah, the reason why we didn't tell Schumer is because that would be like telling the Iranians, right? I mean, like, you know, and so in a world, and, you know, the historically, the reason why I would have been comfortable with this kind of Article II assertion of power is because I had faith that the congressional leadership's, you know, notification would have allowed for them to either say, yes, we support this, no, we don't. I have no faith, right, given the toxicity of our current political climate, that the relevant factual information is being shared with anyone who the president thinks is an opponent at this moment in time.
So I want to separate the notification and role of Congress apart from the decision-making.
Yeah.
And let me talk first about, you mentioned that it all hinges on, or you say it all hinges on imminence.
To me.
To you, right. So I take a different view. I think that actually imminence is a red herring. It's very important from a policy perspective. I get that in the public diplomacy aspects. I think it's legally a red herring here. I think the critical point is the claim that I think at least some of these officials are asserting, and I think is actually the plausible argument here. There is a series of existing attacks that have already occurred that provided already the predicate for action. Now, you point out, okay, but then why not prior action? Why not, you know, at any point previously? The decision as to whether to take advantage of the potentially available legal authority, that's a policy decision, and there's nothing wrong with prior presidents and this president previously having decided not to go there at any point in the past. I don't think that ever disables a future president from making the decision that, okay, at this point, the policy calculus is different. Now, do I have faith that Donald Trump went through some reasonably serious policy calculation? I'm not particularly, no. I doubt that very much. I have a lot of questions about what exactly was going through this person's mind. That won't surprise anyone who listens to this show, because I've, as I said at the outset earlier, I've been saying for many, many years now that this is a person who I don't trust to make reasonable decisions in that respect. But just looking at it from an abstract perspective of could a president reasonably, in light of what may have been the facts here, have decided that Soleimani has ordered enough things to occur that have already caused enough violence to occur to open the door towards a response of this kind? I think that was already the case. It's not a situation in which there needs to be a reasonable basis to believe there was yet another attack coming, another rocket to be launched, another American to be killed. Then it would be okay as long as we thought that was going to happen. I do think that you need to believe that it's not all over and done with, but of course it wasn't all over and done with. I think it's pretty clear.
This gets into a fascinating debate that was going on Twitter between Marty Lederman and Beck Ingber, right, and Ona Hathaway. I'm not going to do it justice, because like a 4,000 tweet debate. But does that does your framing of it that way require the existence of an armed conflict between the United States and Iran?
I don't think it requires one. I think it gives rise to one once you decide, okay, let's simplify the fact pattern rather than keeping it real mushy.
Yeah.
Let's say that the best understanding of the facts, cut off everything prior to 2019. So the world begins in 2019. We're there. Soleimani begins to take an interest then. Obviously, that's not at all how it was. It's been much more thick engagement over time. But let's assume that all there is what I described earlier from the Reuters report, that one government decides to act through proxies, provide them with sophisticated weaponry, and then give them orders to begin launching those missiles, both at the host state's forces and at the U.S. forces there, and that they begin doing so. They don't succeed in killing Americans at first, but then they finally, with a barrage of 30 of them, kill one American, wound others, and there's every reason to believe there's more of the same coming. First of all, I would argue that they are, as a matter of state responsibility, if we want to put on our international law hats, they've got state responsibility for the actions of those militia forces that they are arming and directing, if that's the real fact pattern. I think that follows from Nicaragua, and it follows from many other sources of international law. I don't think that's even a hard call if those facts are accepted as true. I would argue that when one state is doing that against the forces of another state, these sorts of military kinetic engagements, then I think you've actually got a state of armed conflict between them already. Now, both governments may choose not to publicly talk about it that way. They may not take any particular actions for a variety of policy, political, diplomatic reasons. But as a legal description of what's going on, I think they've actually already got an international armed conflict between them. Even if that weren't the case, I certainly think that when the United States military conducts a military strike against an Iranian general, the international armed conflict models, the international law of international armed conflict comes into bear, IHL comes to bear. It is an IAC scenario. So I'm not sure if that's responsive to your question, but I definitely think LOAC at that point governs.
Okay. So, I mean, I guess my bottom line here is I think it is not obvious that the strike was illegal, right, as a matter of domestic law, although then again, the international law questions get much, much messier because it has so much to do with our relationship with Iraq, right?
Right. There's some really naughty UN Charter, Yusad Bellum style questions around this.
This is a strike against a military leader of country C on the soil of country B by country A.
If we'd killed him in Iran,
right,
it would be a straight up
violation of the UN
quite
Charter.
Analogous.
Yeah.
Oh, violate? No. That's not at all where I was going.
Well,
it would be a real sin.
Sorry. It would be a violation of Iran's sovereignty, and the question would be whether it was excused by Article 51.
Okay, yeah. Right, exactly. Right. We would replicate the entire national self-defense type debate, only we'd be talking about it through the lens of Article 51. Was this or was this not a scenario where Soleimani, where Iran, we're focused too much on Soleimani as an individual, as if he's bin Laden, as opposed to a manifestation of the Iranian state. So we would be talking about whether Iran had engaged in an armed attack already, opening the door for the United States to use force, necessary and proportionate force in response. The fact that it occurs within Iraq gets so tricky, because what are we even doing in Iraq? Well, we're there with Iraqi government consent. But their consent is their consent is modulated by constraints on whether and how we use force within their territory. It's all supposed to be Islamic State directed. So, and I don't claim to have an easy answer on exactly how you cash out the Yusad Bellum UN Charter issues there. I do think that the underlying national self-defense issue from Article 2 works out in analogous fashion, involves the same sorts of questions and the same factual predicates as does the Article 51 UN Charter discussion.
So, anyway, All right.
Yeah.
So, I think it's a close call on the Article 2 question. I think it's a closer call than you do.
Yeah, no doubt.
I also think that the fact that, like, this debate is out there shows just how problematic it is, right? That there's no one other than the executive branch to police the contours of Article 2. Right? Because, you know, suppose that I was right and you were wrong, right? It wouldn't matter.
Yeah. Well, let's make it worse. Suppose the whole deal is that actually it turns out that none of these attacks were directed by IRGC. Now, I don't believe that.
No.
But what if it turned out to be true?
And the White House knew it and did this anyway.
Yeah. Right? We'll make it even worse, right? It's a straight up wag the dog.
Right. It wouldn't matter. Right? Like, I mean, it might matter politically, but I don't even think it would matter politically, because what Republican right now is going to stand up to President Trump over this? I haven't seen anyone.
If there was some sort of tape that showed that this was a straight up wag the dog scenario, I would argue that it would matter politically, but maybe I'm optimistic.
There are lots of things I like to think would matter. So sure. All right.
No, well, obviously.
So let's talk about what's happened since. Right, because whatever one thinks of the original strike, some of what's happened since is
Wait, before we leave it, I want
that shit.
I definitely want to go there. Yes. But before we leave where we've been, I want to flag two things, because I do think that it is important for listeners to think about how they feel about this in comparison to prior examples. Mm-hmm. I think the two probably most relevant prior examples: 1986 Operation El Dorado Canyon and the Reagan administration's large-scale set of airstrikes against the Gaddafi regime, mm-hmm. which, to be sure, they were careful to say, we weren't targeting Gaddafi himself. However, they did target one of his residences and ended up killing some of his family. So be careful how we parse the idea that we weren't targeting him.
Right.
And then also the 1998 Clinton administration use of force in Afghanistan, in particular, after the East African embassy bombings, attempting to kill bin Laden and the Shura Council leadership of al-Qaeda, which missed because it took so long for the missiles to get there, but nonetheless was an attempt. In both cases, these were examples in which there was no authorization for use of military force from Congress. There's no statutory foundation. These were both national self-defense, Article II airstrikes conducted in ways that were arguably necessary and proportionate responses to prior attacks that killed Americans. In both those cases, much more visibly attributable and much more high visibility, more media covered events. The East African embassy bombings, of course, were hugely bloody and in the focus of intense attention and relatively clear attribution pretty quickly. The 1986 El Dorado Canyon raid was an immediate response to the Libyan orchestrated bombing of the La Belle discotheque in West Berlin that killed U.S. service members. It was also part and parcel of a larger chain of what we today might call, gray zone type engagements in which Libyans were engaging in all sorts of nefarious activity. I actually think it's quite similar. I think that
it's the Libyans.
I think what happened here was really analogous in some ways, except for the complexity of it taking place in Iraq instead of in Iran, as we said a moment ago, and because the Reagan administration went out of its way to say, hey, we weren't targeting Gaddafi personally. But actually, I think once you're engaged in an international use of force of that scale intensity, if you're otherwise lawfully allowed to do it, I think that because it would be an armed conflict between the two states in that context, if you decide to target Gaddafi himself, if he's the military commander of the Libyan forces in 1986, I think that would have been lawful. And I think it was lawful here as far as the targeting of the individual as opposed to just bombing the building where you're going to kill lots of people.
No, listen, one point where I think you and I don't disagree is in a world in which the strike is otherwise lawful as a matter of Article II authority, right? I think you and I both agree that it doesn't contravene the assassination ban.
Yeah. Right. All right. So anyways, I throw that out there. That's food for thought. I'd be interested if anyone thinks, no, it's distinguishable. I'd love to hear why.
I mean, Iran's not Libya, right? And I mean that in a couple of respects, right? I mean, like, I think the threat Iran as a country poses to the United States is, to me, significantly greater than the threat that Libya as a country posed to the U.S. circa 1986, which is not to say...
I don't think I agree, but I think it's similar.
One of them has a nuclear program and one of them doesn't.
Neither one yet has a nuclear bomb, let alone the missiles to deliver them here. Both of them support terrorism abroad. I think they're quite similar.
Okay. Well, but all, and now we also say, and the Libya stuff was incredibly controversial, and there were a whole lot of people who thought it was illegal.
True. Okay. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. I, my goal is only to establish an analogy. It may not be a helpful analogy
fair
from
enough.
That perspective.
No, listen, I don't think this is the first time we've had crazy shit in this context. I'm cursing a lot today. All right. So it starts...
Then
predictably,
things
run off the rails.
Right. So now we're at the bluster stage.
Yes. So, to the shock of absolutely nobody who understands anything, right? The strike produced immediate blowback from a whole lot of voices and a whole lot of sectors, which, because the president's the president, led him to double down and to threaten all kinds of uses of force against Iran. So let's start with his tweet. threatening that he was going to identify 52 cultural and religious sites to target.
Well, that's not quite what he said, right? Okay. He said that 52 sites included may include cultural sites.
Yes.
I don't think he ever said religious sites, although that might or might not be subsumed.
Okay, fine. 52 sites include cultural. So 52 obviously is the number, right? That number has meaning here.
Yeah, it's based on the hostages.
Right. Targeting cultural sites. That's cool.
Yeah, so clearly you can't do that. If what he means...
But you say clearly he can't do that. Who's going to stop him?
Do you think that military commanders, if Trump issues an order says, I want you to find some museums and some cultural sites, I want you to blow them up, you think they'll just say, yes, sir? I don't think so.
I've seen no evidence to suggest that they won't.
What's your evidence? I turn that back on you and ask for evidence that they would. I think that the burden is on someone who claims the military would obey a plainly illegal order to show me some reason to think that the military would say, yeah, sure, no problem.
I worry about that. I
it's good to be worried for sure, but I'm very doubtful.
All right. So we have Trump threatening war crimes, right? And so we agree, right? Targeting cultural sites is a war crime.
Yeah, it's so there is no question that the principal distinction prohibits attacks on civilian objects. And the only exception to that is when they're being put to use. So if he can identify a cultural site where it's being used militarily, then they waive the protection for it.
But just destroying a museum to destroy a museum.
Yeah. Now there's a further layer. There's a view that says that cultural installations that are civilian objects that also have a further layer of special cultural relevance may even get further protection. You don't need to have any debate about that.
Okay.
You can't attack civilian objects that are not being put to military use.
Can I quote the tweet exactly? Because I think it's somewhere in between what I said and what you said.
Okay, good, yeah.
So the tweet says, blah, 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 bluster, bluster, bluster. Let the service warn that if Iran strikes any Americans or American assets, we have targeted, as in we've already targeted.
Like we know where they are.
Right.
We've got them a list.
52 Iranian sites representing the hostages, some at a very high level and important to Iran and the Iranian culture. Right. So I think he's saying, like, the list of 52 includes cultural.
No, I agree that he's you're right. I think I said maybe.
Right.
And
I want to take out the
May. Yeah, no. He clearly was saying that we will attack something that will include. Now he's obviously, we don't want to fall into the trap of responding to all his bluster because he does bluster, but it's a real risk that he might issue an order to attack civilian objects, and I don't think the military would comply with that.
So
I really don't.
Here's my concern, right? My concern is I would have been assuaged if anyone from his administration stood up and said, obviously the president didn't mean that, right? Obviously the president knows that you can only attack military targets, blah, 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 blah. And instead, you've got people like Pompeo going on the Sunday shows and saying, oh, that's not what he said. Right, like literally saying he said something else, as opposed to if he said that, I would stop him.
I'm not familiar with how they tried to walk back the statement. But to your point, if they were out there trying to walk back the statement, that's a sign that, in fact, even they, who otherwise are real hot to try to pursue this course of action in general, recognize that that's not a place to go.
Lying about what he said is better than actually saying what he said was wrong.
That's not what I said.
I know. That's what I said.
All right.
Okay. So so step one was President Trump threatening to attack cultural sites. Step two, this was the best tweet of them all, was the these media posts will serve as notification to the Congress that should Iran strike any U.S. person or target, the U.S. will quickly and fully strike back, and perhaps in a disproportionate manner.
I know you're
such
like,
legal notice is not required,
but
it's given
nevertheless.
Okay, so we agree, I assume, that disproportionate uses of military force are unlawful?
Yeah, I think that it'd be hard to construct if you were just going to use a few words. And if you said on an exam, like, hey, using like four words.
It'd be too easy.
Issue an unlawful order.
Right.
Conduct a disproportionate strike.
Against cultural.
Now, of course, again, I want to stick and be faithful to my own rule of not playing too much into Trump's hands when he's blustering and BSing and doing these, you know, these bombastic statements and assume that that means, therefore, he's going to issue an order later that's going to be, okay, I purposely direct you to engage in disproportionate response.
I agree, but we are too far into this nonsense of an administration to have the whole, like, don't take anything he says literally.
No, I'm not saying that we shouldn't
care. I know you're
care.
Not, but there are people out there who are. There are people out there who say you can't ever take anything he says literally. And honestly,
like, and therefore everything he says is fine.
Right.
No, I completely disagree with that. What he says really matters. This matters, and that's why we're going to talk about it.
Right.
There's no doubt that whether he's referring to jus ad bellum proportionality, that is to say, that the response to an armed attack in self-defense will be a disproportionate response, or whether he means jus in bello proportionality, that is to say, we're going to intentionally kill more civilians than the than would be warranted under the principle of proportionality, whether he means Article 2 proportionality. There's proportionality in several different relevant frameworks. By definition, if it's disproportionate, then you've contravened the framework.
Whoops.
And again, I don't think that if he somehow could articulate a way of,
yes,
if he said, like, you know, I want a disproportionate response, what he would get would be a response, there would be a weighty response, but it would not be an obviously war crime response, because I don't think DOD's just going to go out there and say, okay, he wants the principal distinction violated, let's do it. He wants principal proportionality violated, let's do it.
I'm trying to remember. There is a whole West Wing episode, I think it's in the first season. It's like one of the early episodes, called proportional response, or like the whole episode, like where like there's like, what are the virtues of a proportional response? And I was like, it's the law.
Oh, I gotta see that. I've not seen that. I will say this though: we don't want to fetishize the idea of proportionality in the sense of making it sound like it's a mathematical calculation, and thereby running the risk of making people think that there's any kind of formula can be brought to bear here. The truth of the matter is, both on the Article 2 and ad bellum proportionality, And to a maybe a lesser extent, but nonetheless a disturbingly real extent on the collateral damage proportionality fronts, the question of exactly what's proportional has lots of room for disagreement.
I completely agree, but literally saying it's going to be disproportionate.
No, I know.
Okay. One small point and then one big one, right, to sort of wrap this up. So third, there were a bunch of reports yesterday that seem to have been sufficiently corroborated to now actually take seriously that Customs and Border Protection has been ramping up its detention of Iranian Americans trying to enter the United States. It's early, right? CBP denies that there's any policy change going on, that there's been any shift in how they approach, you know, arriving. We're not talking about people with no connection. We're talking about people who are living in the United States.
Are we talking about American citizens who also have Iranian citizenship?
There are reports of both. There are reports of dual citizens, there are reports of green card holders, and there are reports of other lawful but non-permanent residents.
Okay, people have the right to be in the United States. So I don't know this news story.
Yeah.
Are they saying that people are being held in custody, or are people being questioned?
So they're being detained for up to 7 or 8 hours and questioned. So it's not clear that anyone's being held beyond that. Right, but that they're being subjected to aggressive questioning about their politics and their networks and all kinds of other things. Now, I say these are just a couple of scattershot media reports. There's a press release from an immigrants' rights groups in the Pacific Northwest. But if this is true, right, and I stress the if, right, that's a rather alarming escalation. It harkens back to the very beginning of the travel ban, right, where there was this knee-jerk reaction, where the original policy was so unnuanced that it swept up all these folks who had, like, clear due process rights to enter the United States, like green card holders.
If we're talking about someone who's an Iranian citizen,
yeah,
who's coming into the United States from wherever,
who's returning to the United States, we're talking about residents.
The claim is only for people who were here already. Okay, so let's hypothesize some individual who is an Iranian citizen, who's got a student visa, goes back to Iran, comes back. I certainly don't think it's crazy in the midst of where we absolutely can and should expect the Iranians to be looking for some way to respond to the killing of their arguably second most important government official, for there to be enhanced screening.
If there's some, this goes back to one of the longest debates in our field, right? Which is individualized suspicion versus mass suspicion, right? And, you know, I would hope fervently that any additional screening, right, is based on facts beyond their national origin, right? That is at least some reason why you believe that someone who's, say, someone's been living in the U.S. I mean, one of the reports is a writer who's been living in the U.S. for 35 years, right? Like, some reason why all of a sudden you think that they warrant additional process beyond the fact that they are, you know, they were born in Iran.
Clearly, that it would sound like both a problematic and stupid way to devote scarce border
security resources. That's never stopped us before.
But I can't say that the idea that in this context, you can't say, all right, we need special focus on people who have ties to Iran of any kind, including people who are not Iranian citizens, but spend a lot of time over there for whatever reason. I think it makes perfect sense for there to be some sort of leveling up of scrutiny at
Again,
the border in this
if
context.
There was, for me, it all rises and falls on whether there's some individualized reason why this person is more suspicious.
Can't we have it both ways in the following sense, that there's in general a decision to focus on Iran as a target set in this sense, and then within that general leveling up to exercise sound individualized suspicion to determine just how long and probing the questioning is going to be? And indeed, isn't that probably, possibly at least, what's actually going on here? That sounds reasonable to me. But the idea that you can't say, all right, we have a special concern with Iran right now, I think that can't be right.
That's not what I'm saying, right?
I know you're saying it needs to be individualized, but I think that it's not just a binary.
Yeah, but suffice to say, you have more faith in CBP than I do.
I don't think that's fair because I don't have a lot of faith in CBP necessarily.
I have none. So
well,
I think
okay,
you have
well
more.
That is fair. Then,
Some
by
is
definition.
More than none.
But I think that the fact that there may be an across-the-board directive. Let's imagine they reveal tomorrow that CBP is issued a directive.
By the way, if they reveal that tomorrow, that means they will have lied yesterday.
Oh, is that right? They denied there's any.
They denied that there's any. They denied that anything was going on at all.
Well, that actually sounds almost incompetent because, in fact, I would argue they should be paying special attention to people with ties to Iran right now.
It was this, Bobby. The thing that got my dander up was the denial, right? Because it's like, wait a second, like it seems like that says, everyone stay calm, we're not, nothing radical has changed. We're just paying
reasonable.
Attention.
This is a dangerous time, and
Consistent with the travel alert that the State Department issued the other day for America. Yeah, like
we're real concerned about Iran right now. We're being careful, but we're not doing anything that's unwanted.
Instead, the response was, nope, nothing to see here.
Well, I agree with you that's ridiculous.
All right, the last thing is just the policy implications, because we pounded into the ground the legal issues, right? Mm-hmm. And I do think that we should talk about why you and I both have the reaction that, legal issues aside, right, this is troubling as a policy matter.
Well, I think it'd be crazy to deny that this is super high stakes and high risk. I suspect you and I may disagree on whether at the end of the day this was unwarranted. What do you think? I'm assuming that you think it was a terrible idea, but are you open to the possibility that in fact, no, this is someone who keeps getting American blood in his hands, and at some point we had to do something that would be effective to stop
that.
But
you said before something very important, right? That it's important to understand the strike against Soleimani is not against the strike against the person, but as a strike against someone who was a senior figure for Iran.
No,
right?
This is an attack on Iran.
And so the question is, well, won't there be another Soleimani, right? And so how much of this is one guy who poses a unique threat versus just we're attacking this guy in his official capacity, right?
So I think there's no question. Obviously, he's already got his replacement. I do think Soleimani, to some extent, was unique due to the tenure and charismatic elements of his leadership and the length of it and the extent to which he was. I really do think he was almost uniquely powerful in this respect. It won't be quite the same as before, but this is an institution. It's not like these ties and capabilities entirely.
But
go
this
away.
Goes to but this goes to my view of the optics, right, and of the policy, because it seems to me that there's no scenario in which Iran won't respond, right, and that the question then becomes like, what does that response look like, and how do we respond in turn,
right?
And I have so little faith at the moment in the leadership of the executive branch to not take any action by Iran, right? Even what we might think of as a proportional response, right? And react aggressively, lawfully or not, react to the fullest extent that the law would allow them, if not beyond that.
I think it's very likely that I think it's not clear that Iran will react quickly. I think the actual tools available to it to react in a way that they feel they can control the escalation spiral. They have to be very concerned about this as much as we do, probably more than we do. I don't think it's obvious how they respond.
Don't you think it's obvious that they'll respond?
I think they are going to feel tremendous pressure to be seen to be responding because the level of provocation was so strong. But let's play it out. So
And because there's a bit of an in-your-face thing going. Like, I mean,
right.
You know.
But again, so what would be enough to respond to the pressure they may feel to be seen to be punching back? So let's say they decide, all right, we're going to have our proxies there, set up some IDs, and we're going to kill X number of Americans in Iraq. It's clear we are going to then respond militarily again.
Right.
And in a larger scale.
Right.
And it becomes a classic question of who's got escalation dominance here. So let's say that they do that. We respond. We don't strike 52 cultural targets. But let's say there's one big airstrike that destroys an IRGC headquarters building and kills a bunch of people inside of it, inside Iran this time. So then they've got to respond again. It's not obvious that they just keep leveling up every time we level up too. It's not clear, actually, who's got the escalation dominance.
I agree, but that's part of why I don't think it's possible to know now, right, whether this was a good idea, right?
Oh, but clearly, that time will tell. It could be. We need to be open to the possibility. It could be that it turns out this was a significant deterrent blow to them, and that this causes them to pull back to some extent on their attacks on Americans. It might.
Suffice it to say, I am far more, if I had to put money down, right, I think it's far more likely that that more Americans will die, right, in response to this than perhaps had this not happened.
I think it's really hard to know. I think it's certainly possible. Yeah. It's also important to build into that calculus, though, how many go on the tab if there had been no action and they continued to provoke and not get this sharp a pushback.
But there's
hard to know.
There's also, insofar as some of that conflict is asymmetric, there's also the question of, it's not just escalation dominance, right? It's also, moral dominance, right, and moral superiority, and whether there's something to be said for taking the high ground. The other piece of this, and I think this is any analysis of the policy ramifications of the strike is going to have to depend upon what this does, if anything, right, to our footprint in Iraq. So the Iraqi parliament voted yesterday, right, to in a non-binding resolution to expel the U.S. military, to otherwise cut off access, blah, 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 things that don't actually have a direct immediate impact, but that will put a fair amount of pressure on the Iraqi government to perhaps not go all the way, but at least try to reach some kind of look like they're doing something to mitigate the footprint, right, to sort of push back against the U.S. a little bit.
I think there's no doubt that if the end result of this is they actually do force the withdrawal of U.S. forces,
or even the substantial downsizing.
We're talking about 5,000 acknowledged forces here, many of whom are there engaged in training in support of the Iraqi military. It matters. I'm not sure how big a blow it is if there's some sort of face-saving negotiation where some number of them
now leave. It's like 3,000.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know how much that matters, especially if what remains is the special operations capability that I have the impression is based out of the Kurdish region in the north anyways, who, by the way, may well stay no matter what the Iraqi parliament or the Iraqi prime minister say. It's entirely possible that the relative independence of the Kurds in that area and the relative emphasis of U.S. special operations capability up there, that all sort of remains.
But if nothing else, don't you think that this only further complicates, right, the political situation in Iraq?
No doubt about it. No, in a way that favors Iran.
Right. Yeah. And so to me is my bottom line, right? Is that when all else is said and done, I think that the most predictable consequences of this strike to me come out good for Iran and bad for us.
I think that's probably right. And I think that there's non-negligible chances it goes the other way.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I have no doubt that we're going to have more to talk about, because I do think that this is going to be a theme of 2020. We're going to be on this topic a lot as the story develops.
This is so depressing.
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week. I suspect we'll have something new to talk about on the business end of the show.
We have the Guantanamo anniversary coming up this Saturday.
Guantanamo anniversary.
Guantanamo is about to be old enough, Bobby, to be sent to Guantanamo.
Oh, I think that line was crossed a while back.
Well, and not violate the Convention on the Rights of the Child.
All right, got topics to talk about.
He's at Bobby Chesney. I'm at Steve_Vladek. We are at NSL Podcast. Stay safe out there. Bye, everybody.
Adios.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, and this week it's produced in cooperation with the National Security Law Podcast, and therefore the University of Texas Law School and the Strauss Center at the University of Texas. Thanks to Bobby and Steve for letting us use the audio. We are interested in your feedback on this. Is this a good cross-posting situation? Should we be doing more of this, getting the National Security Law Podcast discussion into the Lawfare Podcast feed? You should do your part and promote the Lawfare Podcast and the National Security Law Podcast. Tweet about it. Give a little love to Bobby and Steve, both of whom are both on Twitter. You should share it on Facebook. You should review us on whatever podcast distribution service you use. You should buy Lawfare swag at thelawfarestore.com. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our audio engineer for this episode is Hadley Baker. Our music is, as ever, performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.